The Preble's jumping meadow mouse has been listed as an endangered species since 1998. And so we protect the Prebles with environmental restrictions that, in one Colorado neighborhood, include a requirement that cats be kept on leashes. But wait, some have called this endangered listing into question. And so today we ask, should we continue to protect the Preble's mouse?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Ninth edition of the food... Well, maybe there we go. Hello out there. You are tuned into the 559th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Kowloon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Staff.
Hello.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
And who's this? Kelsey Olson's back in town.
Good morning, Dad.
Folks, civilization is not kind to wild things. When we move people out into a neighborhood, wild things move out. We have moved into so many neighborhoods, some wild things have run out of places to move and so have become, well, endangered species. To protect the wild, we identify those species that are endangered and then place them into a blanket of protective measures. For example, in 1998, the Preble's meadow jumping mouse was listed as an endangered species. Consequently, 31,000 acres of land along the waterways of Colorado and Wyoming were designated as critical habitat for the mouse, and restrictions placed on those on the use of that land that some say cost landowners and local governments up to $100 million. Some who had to pay the cost of this listing then claimed that the mouse was not a unique species at all and that all of the regulations protecting it were not needed because, well, there's mice everywhere. Others say no, the Preble's is a unique species and that we must continue to protect it. This leads us to ask today, should we continue this protection? And we'd love to hear what you have to say about it as well. But we have a couple of really great guests who are going to help us out today. And you're invited to hang around and listen to what they have to say. We'll start with Jay Lair, who is the science director for the Heartland Institute. Hello, Jay.
Hello, Michael.
Welcome aboard.
Tell us a little. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you aboard. Where are you at?
Pardon me?
Where are you?
I'm in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, good. Tell us a little bit about the Heartland Institute, and of course, Columbus, Ohio is in the Heartland.
Well, the Heartland Institute actually is headquartered in Chicago, though I work out of an office in Ohio. We are a libertarian think tank, which focuses on five major areas. One is environment and climate, and we put out a newspaper monthly, Environment and Climate News, which is intended entirely for elected state officials, city mayors, and town councils, to provide them with information on environment and climate issues, which is totally objective to help them make educated votes in their areas. We also work and have a similar monthly newspaper, which is called Healthcare News, dealing with healthcare issues. Another is Education Reform News, which deals with our public education system. Another one on tax and budget, and another one on IT, communication issues. And everything is focused on elected state officials to give them objective, unbiased information, kind of like I heard your Fox News on your station, you know, fair and balanced. That's what we try to do. I'm the science director and deal with all the environment and climate issues. I have over a half a century experience in this, and listening to your introduction, anyone can get our newspapers free of charge on our website, www.heartland.org. Actually, if they want it in paper and they mention they heard me on the radio, they can get a six-month free subscription to any of our publications.
Well, with respect to objectivity, we always ask our guests who pays the way.
Well, we have mostly individuals. Nobody is allowed to our overall budget. No one can provide more than 5% of that budget in a single year. We have about 1,500 contributors. Most of them are individuals, very little corporate money. We pretty much just follow our own lead and try to find people that favor a reduced government control over society to contribute to our libertarian efforts.
Okay, thank you very much for that introduction. We'll go to Kieran Suckling, who is the policy director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome to the Food Chain, Kieran.
Good morning.
Glad to have you aboard. Center for Biological Diversity, who are you?
We are a endangered species protection group, and we're based out of Tucson, Arizona, which is where I am,
mm-hmm.
But we work throughout the country. And we primarily work in the realm of endangered species research and endangered species litigation to ensure that laws are being used correctly to protect endangered species and that science is being used correctly.
Good. And who pays your way, Kieran?
We have about 80,000 members and supporters across the country, and they provide most of our funding. And then in addition to that, we get funding from environmental foundations, so folks like the WWF Foundation, the Sandler Family Fund, folks like that. We don't get any government funding.
Okay, so basically we have two organizations that are kind of on the other opposite ends of this endangered species programming. And let's start back to you, Jay. Is it really true what I read in your writing that there is one Colorado Springs subdivision wherein cats must be kept on a leash to protect the Preble's mouse?
That is true, but I think that's, off a slightly outlandish. The main thing is that this huge amount of acreage has been, taken out of...
The 31,000 acres.
The 31,000 acres out of development. I've read all the research on it. The Preble mouse neither seems to be endangered or, in fact, a separate species. We've really altered the way we decide what a species is from what it was 40 years ago. I mean, we're almost moving into different colors of animals and calling them species. So we're going away from the what was established as the way we did our genetic classification, and we're doing it. I really feel like, and there's no greater animal lover on the planet than I. I sleep in a bed with four dogs and three cats, and I'm 71 years old when I get up to go to the bathroom, as I must a couple times
they
every
all
night.
Follow you in, I can
oh
see
my God, no, it's getting back into bed without waking them up and starting a fight and having my wife screaming at me, and so I have to get out of bed carefully and get back into bed carefully. You gotta really love animals, and there are children, and I'm
but you are calling into question this listing. That's
I am. I'm
okay.
Definitely calling into question, and the whole Endangered Species Act, I think, is as often as not used with the hidden agenda, really, of taking land off limits and stopping development. We certainly now know that the spotted owl was not endangered, and we pretty much put down the forestry industry up in the Northwest. We now know that mostly they were endangered from the barred owl, and we found other owls in other areas. So I think the law, which certainly had merit, and I want to see species protected. I love animals. I think it's being used unfairly to take land off the table.
Okay, that's a fair description of your position. Kieran, the Center for Biological Diversity is, I understand it, suing the federal government for interfering with the Endangered Species Act. Is that correct?
Yeah, we are poised to sue the government over overturning scientific decisions in 55 different instances across the country, from Florida to California. And one of those actually does include the Preble's Meadow Mouse and that 31,000 acres of critical habitat that you talked about, because the scientists actually tried to protect a larger swath of land, and they were overturned by a fairly infamous woman at this point, Julie McDonald, a Department of Interior bureaucrat who's since retired in disgrace. She refused to allow them to protect the full extent of land needed for the Preble's Meadow Mouse, and so we'll be in court over that shortly.
So we have a great conflict brewing over the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse and related endangered species. And that's going to be our conflict today here on The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Jay Lair, who's the science director of Heartland Institute, Karen Suckling, who is with the Center for Biological Diversity, and of course we're talking with you. Do you think we should continue protecting the Preble's Mouse? And furthermore, we're going to ask when we come back, how on earth does a species like the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse become listed as an endangered species? And once listed, where does that take us? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 are the phone numbers. Pick up your phone and give us a ring and let us know what you think. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
31,000 acres. That's how much land we set aside under a protective blanket so that the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse could survive in this world of more people and less space, I guess you might call it. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the Endangered Species Act in general and the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse in particular. And I guess there's a lot of particulars that we could look at. 55 that you're suing the federal government over. Kieran from the Kieran Suckling from the policy director for the Center for Biological Diversity, you're suing the federal government over 55 of these questionable rulings.
Yeah, I am. One of the most powerful and important aspects of the Endangered Species Act is that it requires that all decisions be made upon the best available science.
Yeah.
All too often, after the scientists send their decision up to the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., those bureaucrats overturn those decisions.
So we have scientific criteria, and then we have political criteria, right?
Yeah, because even though the law is based on science, at the end of the day, it's the bureaucrat who makes the decision, and all too often in that space between the scientist and the bureaucrat, the scientific information gets lost.
Let me go to Jay Lair, the science director for Heartland Institute. Any disagreement so far with what Kieran has to say?
Very definitely. I read the science. I question the science, as I said, the way we're defining species to begin with and endangered species. Secondarily, has become so broad as to essentially make man a second class citizen.
Well, is that not a political consideration then? I mean, is there an objective way of looking at this at all?
I do. I think there is an objective way, and I think that we declare species or have declared species endangered on very thin evidence, whereby we've not really looked at a broader landscape to see if, in fact, they lived in other habitats, to see if, in fact, a man was truly encroaching on them to the point of that they couldn't live anywhere else. We've defined species in a broader manner than we ever considered. I mean, where color actually is not.
Well, can we look at this Preble's mouse, and why did we declare it to be an endangered species? Let's look at this little mouse in the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains.
Well, I think we, to be very honest, and again, I'll challenge my debater as for a love of animals. I think the only animal I can recall ever killing is a mosquito. I neither hunt or fish. Have a fish
pond. But why did we declare the Prebles to be endangered?
Well, I really think we declared the Preble mouse an endangered species for the purpose of putting land off of the table for human use.
Okay, Kieran?
We declared, if I say we, the U.S. government, Fish and Wildlife Service, reviewed the status of the Preble's meadow mouse for approximately 13 years, and then in 1998 declared it to be endangered. And the reasons they gave were that its historic range had declined dramatically on the order of 80%. And the number of mice that were known had declined dramatically on the order of about 70%. And then where it still continued to live was under great threat, primarily from development, pollution, and dams. So there was very strong reason to feel that this is a species that is in the process of disappearing, and in fact could disappear. So that's why it was listed.
It keeps striking me that that there is a political element to the scientific criteria that's being used to evaluate which species should be included here. Is there a way of looking at a species and actually measuring whether it is endangered? I mean, we looked at this Preble's meadow jumping mouse and said, you know, its territory is diminishing, and yet other people say, well, no, not really. Its territory is actually quite large because it's really not in a unique species into itself, too. So is there a scientific way of really getting a hold of this and keeping the politics out?
Well, there's two separate questions that you ask, I think, need to be dealt with separately. One would be, is it endangered? And the second would be, is it a species? Because it needs to be both of those to go on the list.
Okay, let's take both of them separately, then.
So looking at the first one, is it endangered? There's a little bit, I don't know if I'd call it politics exactly, but there's certainly a judgment call. I mean, you figure out how many are there, how much development is going on, you know, what's this look like out into the future, and you make a scientific judgment call of whether it's endangered or not. And I don't think there's any way to eliminate that judgment from the system, but you try very much to base that judgment upon good factual information.
Okay, let's go to Jay and ask him the same question.
Well, I think that's a very good answer. I don't know that I can improve on that. The one part of the equation, though, that's left out is the impact on society and mankind. Michael, we only live...
Well, I'm going to get to that next, but the first I'm trying to work my way through this
mouse
thing.
Well, I think you made a very good answer. It's very difficult.
Okay.
In the end, it's a judgment, it's subjective, and it is politics.
Okay, good. So even there, we're in a political situation. Now, how do we know whether this species is a unique species?
Well, yeah.
Kieran, let's start with you.
Okay. Yeah, and this is a bit more of a scientific question and not as much in judgment. Two ways have been used historically. One is based on what the animal looks at. And so, you know, the size of the leg and the length of the tail, the color that Jay objected to so much before. That's one way. That's the traditional way. More recently, as genetic studies and genetic ability has increased, we can actually go and look at the gene pool of this animal versus other animals. So when the meadow mouse was listed in 98, we had some descriptive differences between it and others, and we also had some genetic information at that time. Not a lot, but there was some, and the agency declared that based upon these two different processes, we declare that it is a endangered species. Now, since then, we've had two more sets of genetic studies done that have been much more comprehensive, and those have been subject to three different peer review panels. One study said it's not a distinct species. The other said it was. All three peer review panels agreed with the second study that it was, that it is a subspecies.
Okay, Jill, let's go quickly. Jay, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so...
I mean, that's exactly accurate. I can't argue that at all.
Okay, so essentially, we are pretty sure that it's a unique species, but we're not really sure.
Right, and that's enough for me. We're not really sure. I mean, we're doing things not with scientific precision, but actually subjective opinion on two studies that that disagreed with each other. And so clearly it comes back down to subjective political bias and then the cost.
Which is where we're going to go when we get back. What impact does an endangered species listing have on communities of people? Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Lawson here. We're having a little fun talking about the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse and its listing as an endangered species and the impact that listing is having on people in the Front Range of the Pacific or the Rocky Mountains, but also on other species, 55 others at least around the country, and the impact those listings are having on communities of people. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we've got Jay Lair, Science Director, Heartland Institute. We have Kieran Suckling, who is the Policy Director for Center for Biological Diversity, and we have you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Hey, we're back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the Endangered Species Act and which animals get listed and why they get listed and what happens when they do get listed. Today we kind of are focusing on the Preble's Jumping Meadow Mouse, which is hanging out there on the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains, somewhere around the Colorado Springs area. It's lives in about 31,000 acres of protected area. And what happens to the people who live in and around that 31,000 acres? What happens to communities of people when an animal is listed as an endangered species? We're going to be talking about that now with Jay Lair, who is the Science Director of the Heartland Institute, and also Kieran Suckling, who is the Policy Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. So we listed the, in 1998, we listed the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse. Who named it that anyway? Does anybody know?
I think the fellow who first discovered it was a guy by the name of Preble.
Preble's, okay. And then it would be a jumping meadow mouse.
Yes.
So one closes one's eyes and sees a meadow in which there are jumping mice.
Yeah, and if you were looking especially near the stream, you'd be about right.
Huh. Okay, so, oh, that means we're looking at watercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wow. So what happens when we list a jumping mouse that happens to live close to water as an endangered species? What happens to the environment and to the communities of people who live in and around that environment?
Well, Michael, let me try to handle this. The sad thing is that the Endangered Species Act is somewhat written backward. It is a disincentive to preserve our beloved animals.
How do you mean it's an endangered species?
I'll explain that. It is a disincentive. Let's say that I am a farmer on the Colorado Front Range around Colorado Springs, and I've been reading all the articles about the Preble jumping mouse, a very cute animal indeed. And so I get to the point where I might be able to recognize it, and I see one jumping on my farmland. Well, if I know enough about the Endangered Species Act, I may recognize that if a few more of these mice are found on my land, I may not be allowed to farm it any longer. I mean, it may come under various environmental regulations, and I'm going to lose the full rights to my land. I then might decide in my own best interest I'd be better off killing that mouse, certainly not reporting it and shoveling a hole and get rid of it so that I do not lose my property rights. If the Endangered Species Act had been written in a manner where to find this species on my property, somehow the government would incentivize me to create a habitat on that land that will allow the mouse.
So you'd be out there feeding them, right?
Absolutely.
Hand feeding the mice. Well,
I really believe that the Endangered Species Act has been a disincentive to regular folks who like animals because of the rather radical way it reduces our property rights.
Okay, good enough. Kieran Suckling.
Well, I mean, there's always a few bad apples out there that are going to do the wrong thing in any realm you look at.
But don't you think they would have a significant incentive to do the wrong thing?
Most people do not. I mean, most people like endangered species, like mm-hmm. conservation.
But if they're going to lose the right to use their land.
Well, let's just get right to that, because that's just simply not true. I mean, if you look at the government's economic analyses that have been done for the species, this is the one that says it's about $100 million over 10 years to protect the species. Say less than 1% of that comes from impacts to agricultural interests. So it's not a farming issue. The impacts primarily come from housing developments,
mm-hmm. manufacturing, anybody who uses water courses.
So, I mean, the bottom line here is that, yeah, protecting endangered species costs some money. Protecting endangered species requires that we manage our public and private land better. But it's the same thing for pollution. If we want clean waterways, that requires that we manage our public and private land better. So this is nothing new. It's not outrageous. It's a very reasonable cost. And it's a cost, at the end of the day, makes our communities more livable better.
I agree with you. I think everything good costs something.
But no, I agree with you.
Just a minute, Jay. I'd like to ask Kieran to respond to your contention that if we were to somehow provide incentives to people to husband these animal resources like the Preble's meadow jumping mouse, that there would be more mice than there were under the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, if I find these mice jumping on your land, I'll give you $100.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there have been a whole series of incentive programs developed starting back probably in 1995, which provide funding, technical assistance to landowners who either want to, you know, do better management, or maybe they want to sell their land, or however it is. So we've got a lot of incentive programs out there. I suspect that they will never be enough of those programs to satisfy everybody, but certainly that's, in fact, if you look at the Endangered Species Act budget over the last 10 years, those incentive programs are the largest growing part of it. Now, it doesn't mean that we get rid of regulation because we have incentives, but we do them both at the same time.
Jay?
Well, Kieran is right. In agriculture...
Are you guys really agreeing all this much here?
I don't know. We need different species.
Let me just say this. It's obvious to me that Kieran is an extremely intelligent, well scientifically trained and very articulate, and I'm delighted to be discussing the issue with him. We still disagree very much on the bottom line of the issue. In agriculture, we have a new environmental quality improvement program that gives farmers money to improve the environment on their farm. We have a conservation security program that does similar things. So we do have some incentive programs, but the biggest problem is the Endangered Species Act, which is just terribly poorly written and has reduced the ability of individuals to have control of their property. And the part of the equation that Kieran has not mentioned, that you have not mentioned, Michael, that just doesn't exist, is the economic impact on society.
That's where we're going next. So you're one step ahead of me as usual on the show, Jay. So hold on, because that's going to be our next big question. But right now we're going to go to Rich. And say hello, Rich. Welcome to the food chain.
Good morning.
I was curious as to how many of these mice are we talking about of these 31,000 acres? Are we talking about a family of 10 or about 5 million of them?
Well,
and have we eliminated the aerial predators and the snakes on the ground? Because obviously you can't put them on leashes.
Okay, Kieran?
Yeah, in terms of the mice occur at a much broader area than the 31,000 acres. But in terms of total numbers of mice, they exist in the thousands. Aerial predators is a big issue, and that is we are trying to deal with that. And that goes right to land management, because when you've got lush river vegetation, the mice are hidden from those prairial predators and are fairly safe. When developers come in, take out all the grasses and shrubs, put in lawns, now those predators can see them directly. So
okay, whoops, I'm sorry. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we do come back, we'll finish that question, but it is a good question. And we'll go to the real question of the day, which is, can one economy that protects its endangered species compete against another economy that does not? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, right back.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Well, folks, you know, we do love our animals, and we do protect them. We do what we can to protect them, and when we see that some are endangered, we take extraordinary means to protect them. For example, the Preble's meadow jumping mouse we saw as being endangered, so we listed it as an endangered species, and we set aside 31,000 acres to protect it, costing those who own that land and the governments therein somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million, which is a lot of money, and yet we have our mouse. So the question that we're going to take right now is, can one economy like ours that protects its endangered species successfully compete against an economy that does not afford this kind of protection to wild things? And specifically, I'd like to start with Kieran, ask you, does China have an Endangered Species Act?
China does not. Canada, Australia, and other Anglo countries do.
Mm-hmm. So really, we're looking at China here, because that's what we're really competing with these days with respect to manufacturing and growing things.
Right.
We have to bear these costs. They do not. And so it's much cheaper for them to manufacture things and grow things. And that's why when we go down to the box store to buy garlic, it now comes from China instead of Gilroy. So where do we go from here?
Well, I think it'd be useful to look at China, because not only does it not have an Endangered Species Act, it has few environmental laws at all. And it's a fantastically polluted, eroded nation with dramatic effects, not just on wildlife, but on the humans who live there. And I think most of us would agree that is not the kind of trashed environment we want to live in. And I think the way we've gone here in the U.S. with our environmental laws has provided a much healthier environment for humans than all living things.
Yeah, okay, Jay Lair, we have a nicer environment than theirs, and yet we can't even manufacture our own toothbrushes anymore.
Well, I think, Michael, you're a little off on this point. I while I'm violently opposed to the Endangered Species Act as it is written, because it is primarily used less to protect species than to impede development at all levels of human society in this country,
mm-hmm.
I don't honestly believe that it is a major economic deficit to us with regard to trade to China. As Elon says, they have very few environmental laws overall. The fact that we have to obey, by and large, a good set of environmental laws puts us at a disadvantage. I don't think the Endangered Species Act is a critical part of that, and we wouldn't want to trade our spectacular environment for their rather gross and
Of course not, but yet we must compete with them on an economic basis.
Right, but that's not the argument. The argument is strictly the cost to our own local society, to development,
mm-hmm.
to progress. I don't think it's an international trade issue. It's much more
of a property rights issue. You don't think it adds costs to cost of doing business here in the United States?
I think that looking only at the Endangered Species Act alone, I think the cost is minimal in terms of foreign trade. Looking at overall our environmental laws, there's no question that it adds cost, and I don't, I'm certainly not ready to eliminate those costs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess the question I really want to ask is, what do you think of people who advocate for our environmental cleanliness and friendliness, and who are perfectly willing to add these costs onto our costs of doing business for our farmers and for our industrialists and for our developers, and then go down to the box store and buy stuff made in China from that is manufactured in an environment that has been completely degraded?
You've really phrased it very in a fascinating manner. You're absolutely right. They are willing to put us at a disadvantage and then take advantage of cheap goods from overseas. I don't know, again, I don't want to restrict people's right to go to any store and buy any product, and it just comes with the territory. What I want to do is not allow an endangered species to have 31,000 acres protected for a questionable mouse to the deficit of $100 million in human costs of property rights and development rights. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I would suspect that all 55 of the lawsuits that Elon has explained that his organization is involved in to make the Endangered Species Act more effective, each one of those was judged by a judge to reduce the impact of the Endangered Species Act because the economic impact on society was too great and the benefit to the species was too little. And I think that's the way it should be done. We have to factor in human economic costs on a local level before we just indiscriminately take the endangered species and rope off a gigantic piece of land off bound to human society.
Well, Kiran, let me pitch my question to you. What? I guess we have to take a quick break, but
okay.
I'd like to pitch that to you when we get back because it's something that I don't know. I'm one of those people who loves animals and think that we should protect animals, and I also am one of those people who like to do business and like to drive a nice car and whatnot. And so I'm kind of stuck in the middle of this question here. I personally think that we should pay the costs, but when we have to pay those costs and then we run down to the box store and buy stuff made from China, I'm not sure that we're serving ourselves very well. And so I'm going to ask Kiran what he thinks of those kinds of political and social and economic votes. You know, when people vote with their feet, that's really what they're going down to the store and making a big statement. So I'm going to ask Kiran about that when we get back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. So the question boils down to an economic and I guess even a spiritual one. How do we protect our environment and how do we protect our animals and how do we keep the most clean and beautiful, pristine country in the world that way, and still compete in a world of economic necessity? How do we compete with China, which has no environmental laws, which probably has no animals left because they've all been et? So we enforce these restrictions and regulations on ourselves to maintain our cleanliness and our friendliness. And then we run down to the box store and we buy stuff made from China. Kiran, I just don't get it.
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting issue because, you know, thus far we've been talking about economic impacts in the most general sense. But when you get down to it, it's almost always one economy versus another. And I think one of the big issues playing out in our country today is small local economies versus larger national or international mm-hmm. economies. And certainly we as consumers have some ability to influence that to the extent that we move our money toward the local economy.
Yeah, we vote with our pocketbooks.
Yeah.
I mean,
so,
we say one thing and we vote with our pocketbooks the other thing.
Yes, we do it all the time. You know, it's the allure of the cheap product, right? I think until we as individuals decide, you know what, this organic thing costs a little more, or this food from my local farm over here maybe costs a little more, but by spending that money there, I'm promoting open space. I'm promoting keeping these farms in business. I'm eating better.
I'm preserving the Preble's meadow jumping mouse.
Well, and we should see how that plays in here. I mean, the primary threat to the mouse is development. Most of that development involves the conversion of either farmland or ranch land to sprawl. So the conservation of this mouse, if we do it correctly, should lead to preservation of these ag and farmlands and preventing them from being converted into development. I think that's a good thing for the community.
But only if we patronize those farms
and
industrialists who are willing to pay the cost of maintaining those restrictions and those regulations. I mean, if we enforce those restrictions and regulations on farmers and manufacturers, and then we run down to the box store and buy stuff, we're really just, I think we're being dangerously hypocritical. And I think that we should enact a new law. We'll call it dangerous hypocrisy, and we'll throw people in jail for 3 years for advocating one thing and buying another.
Well, you know, if we are putting, say, restrictions on, you know, when we complain about a farmer selling out to a developer, you know, it's fair to ask, well, why is he doing that? It turns out that's a better deal for him because he's maybe not making the
money. Listen, I just ran out of time, but I just want to thank both of you for riding along with us today and illuminating the situation. Jay Lair, Science Director, Heartland Institute. Kiran Suckling, Policy Director, Center for Biological Diversity. This has been The Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.